I will call the 5 p.m. February 28th joint meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules and the Senate Committee on Rules to order. Senator Farrioli?
Let me gavel in the Senate side of this joint committee because we are separate but together. You have to open up both sides, both the Senate and the House have to gavel in, so we create a joint record. Senator Brown, who wanted to be here, is engaged in other legislative business in the building. She'll be here in a few minutes. In the meantime, we're going to begin by impaneling our invited testimony on 10 bills. So let's go ahead and open the public hearing on all 10 bills.
Okay, I will open a public hearing on Senate bills 494, 495, 496, 497, and 498, and House bills 2594, 2595, 2596, 2597, and 2598. This is an informational meeting.
And I, on behalf of the Senate, will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 494, 495, 496, 497, 498, and House Bill 2594, 2595, 2596, 2597, and 2598. And if we could have the first panel join us at the dais, and that would be Lane Shetterly, Hardy Myers, and Greg Moe.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Co-chairs, members of the committees, pleased to be here this evening. For the record, my name is Lane Shetterly, and I am here appearing this evening in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. My brief role in the rollout of these bills for your hearing, I think the Senate has heard this substantially, but not the House members, and so my role this evening is really just to give you a background on the Oregon Law Commission ethics reform package of bills, the project that the Commission undertook, and then you'll receive some further introductory remarks from Mr. Mao, seated to my immediate left, and from the Attorney General, who both of whom were involved in the project. To orient you to the bills that you are receiving information on this evening, we go back to November of 2003. Actually, even preceding that, House Bill 3328 was a bill enacted by the legislature in 2003. That was an effort to reform substantial aspects of the government ethics statutes. Governor Kulongoski vetoed House Bill 3328, and at that time, as part of the his action, requested the Oregon Law Commission to review government ethics laws in ORS Chapter 244 and to prepare comprehensive revisions for recommendation to the next regular legislative session. That was his request. It came in the form of a letter to the Law Commission. I'll just digress briefly to explain that the Law Commission was created in 1997 to undertake a continuous program of law reform. We represented in our membership through a legislative appointment, through governor's appointment, through appointment from the Oregon Bar Association, and the deans of Oregon's three law schools. We meet on a regular basis, and one of the ways that we engage with legislation is by request either from the legislature or, in this case, from the governor to undertake particular projects, and that was how the ethics work group of the Ethics Project came to the Commission. The Commission did accept the Governor's request with one little condition, that we be granted until 2007 to come back with the recommendations recognizing the scope of the charge from the Governor. That was agreed upon, and we began our project with a really what was a research effort to look at other states, kind of get a sense of what the landscape is around the country on ethics laws, recognizing that you find iterations of government ethics and government practices statutes in all 50 states and at the federal government. And so we began with a review of the law around the country. That then came back to the commission as a report, essentially indicating what the scope of the review would be. And at that point, the law commission expanded the charge to involve lobbying, campaign finance, and funding of administration of Oregon's ethics laws as well. That was ratified during the 2005 legislative session by the legislature asking the commission to undertake that scope of review. And so in November of 2005, after the passage of legislation during 2005 to direct that review and also to fund it, the commission under Attorney General Hardy Myers' leadership as head of the work group started on the review, the product of which you have before you today. That work group eventually split into two parts. Mr. Mao was chair of one of the sub-work groups, and Attorney General Myers continued with the other. Those work groups met for the past 2 years in preparation for the legislation that you see before you in this legislative session. The membership of the work group was appointed by me as chair of the commission in consultation with the Attorney General as representative of members of the Legislative Assembly, as well as members of the lobby, public members, business, and other interests in the legislative process. And it also was attended by a large group of advisors who were technically members of the work group, but who did participate, some of them extensively, in the meetings of the work group. The work group's efforts were public. They were thorough and involved several meetings, often more than one meeting a month, particularly by the work groups. And so what we have before you is, in the bills that you are looking at this evening, is the product of that. The effort has been endorsed by the full law commission and so comes to you with the imprimatur of the of the commission, and so I appreciate your giving us the time to present that to you. I hope this background has been a little bit helpful in understanding how it has come to you, initially through the governor's directive, then that directive being affirmed and expanded upon by the legislature itself in 2005, and now the bills that you have before you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, other members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to add a few further introductory remarks before you reach the point of reviewing the measures themselves. When we got underway as a full work group, and I was more than pleased to accept Lane's invitation to chair the overall effort, I think we tried to identify at least certain guiding principles that would help shape the considerations that were brought to the task at hand. And I want to just take a couple of moments to note three or four of those. First, there was early on, I think at the full work group stage, before we actually began working as subgroups, a decision that we would maintain a unitary structure of administering and enforcing and interpreting the ethics laws, as opposed to perhaps creating multiple governing ethics entities based on some rationale of local versus state or whatever. And I think the driving, dominating concern there was probably a concern about a drift toward inconsistent interpretations and applications of the basic body of law with which we're dealing here. I think we endorse the principle that we would be seeking to enhance or ensure the uniformity of the application of these rules, their application to all public officials uniformly, except to the extent there might be seen some compelling reason to create some departure for that with respect to certain one or more kinds of public officials. I think we were committed to the principle of transparency of the rules, of the laws, in the sense of their clarity, striving for as much clarity in the provisions as we could achieve. And then I think we also early on resolved that we felt it would be better to try to maintain a certain amount of continuity with the existing structure of laws rather than starting from scratch and building a complete new set of ethics codes, ethic laws. in part a consideration of the availability of time, but I think also, frankly, a consideration that an entirely from-scratch ethics code would be probably that much more difficult for the legislature to digest and accept. And so that we would strive for the improvements that we thought we ultimately would identify as needed within the basically the existing framework of law. And then finally, and very importantly, I think that there was agreement that we would seek to arrive at ultimate decisions that we felt were consistent with certain basic, if you will, ethical principles. That, most importantly, I suppose, that public service is a public trust. And that from that flows the principle that public officials should not use public office for private gain. And that public officials should seek to act as impartially as they can and avoid improperly preferential treatment in decision-making. Those that I think were at least the main sort of animating principles that guided the work of the subgroups. As indicated, I chaired the one of the two, which was the more or less, you might say, the substantive work group. Dealing with the actual substantive policy issues, and I would just conclude by noting that that subgroup's work and in turn the resulting measures from that work group really arrayed themselves into six different categories. One was the use of campaign contributions. Second, gifts, honoraria, and financial gain. Third, conflicts of interest. Fourth, subsequent employment of public officials and nepotism. And then fifth, substantive reporting requirements. And sixth, lobbying. Those six areas were the topic areas into which the work of the subgroup I chaired were
organized. Chair, could you repeat those again so I could...
Yes, could you repeat those categories?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Of course. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, number one, that is just in the order here, use of campaign contributions. Number two, gifts, honoraria, and financial gain. Three, conflicts of interest. Four, subsequent employment and nepotism. Fifth, substantive reporting requirements, and sixth, lobbying.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, committee members, my name is Greg Mao. I am an attorney in private practice with the law firm of Stoll Reeves, LLP, in Portland. I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission, and I was asked to serve as a work group chair for the sub-work group, which we call the procedural work group. And just generally, in terms of the bills that will be presented to you tonight, our group was largely responsible for at least initiating many of the concepts which appear in House Bill 2595 and House Bill 2596. It may be helpful just to give a little background on the scope of our work group. And I would note that we had an excellent sub-work group, which included Justice Hans Lindy, who is here tonight, also Representative Vicky Berger, who contributed ably, together with John Schoon, a former chair of the GSPC, and two attorneys in private practice, Margaret Olney and Keith Garza. We were charged to take a very broad look at how ethics laws are administered, and we spent a considerable amount of time hearing from the GSPC as to what works well, what doesn't work well, what are the frustrations. And we also had a number of advisors and invited guests who really spoke from sort of the consumer end in terms of how the GSPC works in aiding public officials in fulfilling their ethical obligations. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the basic structure of the GSPC, where it should be positioned in government, how its members should be appointed, and ultimately did not recommend any radical changes in the basic structure. We looked at a number of specific areas which seemed to be problem areas either from the public officials or from the GSPC itself. Those included rulemaking and the extent to which rulemaking should be widely utilized, the process of issuing advisory opinions and doing it in a fashion where they can be relied upon by public officials. We looked at the procedures by which ethical violations are reported and processed. We looked at the sanctions which are imposed. We looked at funding in terms of funding methodology, what is the best way to fund the GSPC. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about a few areas in which the GSPC differs from other administrative agencies, one of them being the opt-out provision, and we wound up with a fairly elaborate construct which represents somewhat of a compromise between administrative law and the ability to opt out into Marion County Circuit Court. All these issues will be discussed in greater detail in the staff presentation, but it was our privilege to work on this interesting question.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
Well, I have a question for you, Madam Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Well, we have will there be more testimony on this particular 2596 and that?
Yes, we'll be getting much more detailed testimony
before you move on
as we go forward.
Right.
So.
Wonderful. Thank
and
you.
And I wonder if the panel members are able to stay and help explain and provide some of the background to how the decisions were made to roll the bills out. Is that possible?
Like, I mean, in terms of which bills, how the concepts were grouped into bills and how those bills were assigned?
Yes, if any of the members have questions.
Oh, well, I can answer that now if you like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, I wonder if that might be beneficial after the staff presentation, and I'm asking if you'll be remaining after the staff presentation.
I have a meeting up in Senator Brzezinski's office. I can swing back down or leave staff with my cell phone if they need to reach me.
Okay.
Or I could answer it in 2 minutes now if you want it now.
Well, let's do the 2 minutes.
Okay.
And actually, coming into the start of session, I met, I think Hardy was involved with the chair, Chair Rosenbaum and Chair Brown, to go over the list. We had at that point several legislative concepts that had were not grouped as you see them in these bills today. We worked with committee staff and with the chairs to assign LCs to particular combinations for bill introduction and then to determine which of those bills would be started in which house. So that was really worked out with in combination with the chairs of the House and Senate Rules Committee at the beginning of session.
I have a question on a specific bill. Would you like to entertain that now? Or?
Try it, sure.
Senate Bill 494 appears to me to be a relatively major departure from current practice, which is in Senate Bill 494 you have a prohibition against a member of the Legislative Assembly from participating in consideration of a matter in regard to which the member has an actual conflict of interest. Today, our practice is to require disclosure prior to a legislative act, which would be the act of voting. I guess I'm interested in knowing what it was that led to such a radical departure from current practice.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think the staff presentation will take you through the development of that bill. I guess in terms of explaining process again, it began with the large the work group, the testimony they received on that. They developed the concept, presented it to the commission. Frankly, I don't recall that bill was unanimously approved by the commission, but it received at least a majority approval by the commission to go forward And then, again, through the process of assigning bills to committee, was assigned as Senate Bill 484 to the Senate. Okay. So the specific discussion and deliberations on that, I think, can be better addressed probably in the context of the staff presentation of the bills themselves.
On behalf of the Senate side of the committee, there are no further questions. I'd like to just express great gratitude to the commission for undertaking the issue. It seems like a long and arduous process that's resulted in these recommendations. And of course, I have no idea what the fate of these recommendations will be, but I certainly appreciate the effort.
Would you?
Thank you.
Questions from House members?
I'd like to entertain a comment.
Comments.
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Nelson.
Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I'm just checking out, and thank you for the work that you've done on this. You know, as elected officials, we have two reporting requirements, one through the Secretary of State and the other one through the standards and practices. And the six items that were read off that I had to ask again because I couldn't write fast enough, they seem to cover both of those. I mean, are we involved with both of those reporting requirements under your six criteria?
Are we clear on what the question is?
I believe so. I'm just double checking.
We're conferring.
Did you want to use the lifeline? Or?
My campaign finance report.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I believe it's just the GSPC reporting requirements that are really addressed in these policies. That was your question.
That was my question, yes. So it just really goes to the standards and practice reporting requirements. That's what I'm going to. And the reason I asked that question, Madam Chair, is in the Senate committee, we seem to struggle with, were we talking about campaign finance reform or are we talking about ethics reform? But, there's campaign contributions involved in this, and I think it really creates a lot of difficulty for us. And one of the questions that we had, or one of the suggestions we had in our Senate committee was, we made a suggestion and we had a hand raised in the back and say, came and said, well, that's going to be very hard for us to do, for me to administer. And so I guess my next question is was there some criteria? And I have a list of criteria here. One, it's easy and flexible to administer, provides adequate information to the voters, lowers barriers to political activity and fosters competitiveness, that combats influence peddling and increases our accountability, and that promotes true equality. And what I'm looking at these bills is we already have about 85 pages that out of Secretary of State's office that we have to follow, that's very difficult to follow. And then we got this other thing from the standards and practice. And how does he, or how do those people audit those things together? There's got to be some connection, because there's a $71 limit over here, and then there's a $100 limit here, and then there's $146 limits indexed to inflation. And what I'm trying to figure out is, are these bills, how are they going to solve the problem? Are they just going to make it more difficult for us to follow the law?
I think that's an excellent question, and certainly one that we discussed, I know, when we had some of our previous meetings. Did you want to respond?
Well, just with an observation, Madam Chair, it's really not an answer to the question. I think the connection between those two will probably become clearer in the staff presentation, but it may be helpful to keep in mind that your GSPC reporting requirements extend to a much broader array of public officials than those who run for office. And so it would be, I would imagine that's why we have two separate bodies of law, one for campaign finance and one for government standards, because again, the GSPC statutes extend to school teachers, they extend to fire chiefs, they extend to everybody who comes under that broad definition of public official. Which makes it hard to merge those two, because public officials really are just a subset of the larger body of public officials that come under GSPC.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I add just quickly?
Yes, please.
I think Senator Nelson, too, we in the early organization of the topics addressed by the subgroup I chaired, we fell into initially using the title of campaign finance to describe really what became a single issue. That was the use of campaign contributions. Campaign finance, as a title, suggests a much broader investigation and topic, including the whole fundamental question of how should campaigns be financed? Should there be a public finance role and so forth? That's why, as I read off the topics of that my subgroup, I was very careful to describe that overall topic as simply use of campaign contributions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from House members? Vice Chair Berger.
I have a comment, not a question. Members of the committee, as someone who was on the work group, a word about process from my point of view that may help you to understand how this went. The topic was huge, and it had to be broken down into digestible bites, if you will, and we did it by way of work group, and the work groups would work whatever piece, and I was on one that was the topic of the day, if you will, and chew on it a lot and look for consensus as to do we agree this is the direction and this is the way we should go, and work towards it, and then we'd send that to the full group, and then that would go to the law commission, and then that goes to the legislature. So all along the way, there were these sort of, and always at the end, it was what with the idea that at the end, the legislature is going to decide these things. I mean, I guess I don't want to say we're walking in here with done deals, or anybody thought we were walking in here with done deals. But this is the best thinking of the groups that were assembled as to how to address this problem, and further, they do articulate against each other, and I think if you see the entire staff summary of all of them, which I'm hoping we're about to see, you'll be able to get a better sense of the body of it rather than just looking at points within, you know, a specific, because they do sort of articulate against each other. So I hope that the staff presentation, which I have seen, after working on bits and pieces of it, when I saw the whole presentation, I said, oh, that's how that all fit. So I hope that helps you, too.
Other committee members? Okay, senators, are we...
I think we should move on.
Okay, thank you very much for your introduction. And for our next panel, we'll call Wendy Johnson and Sam Sears. Please come forward and join us. Good evening.
Thank you.
Looks like they plan to be here for a while.
I'm feeling a little under the
Committee chairs, vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I've got a cold, so Sam and I have decided to just spread apart a little ways just to keep some distance, plus we're going to be sharing the computer back and forth. It's my privilege to be here after working on this project for about 2 years now to go over relatively high level, but getting into some details as necessary, the Law Commission's recommendations. And before I go too far, I want to make sure that you have before you the PowerPoint presentation in hard copy that I'll be going through on the screen as well. In addition to that, you should have a Law Commission report written by Jerry Watson, who's special counsel to the Law Commission, that I want to especially call your attention to the front couple of pages that provide an index to, if you want to look up a particular bill, it will provide you information on what the recommendations were and what the background was. But tonight, I'm not actually going to be referring to specific bill numbers, as there's just too much stuff in 10 bills. I think we'd all be confused. So if you look up a given topic, you can then find which bill that topic would be covered. I should also comment that many times conforming amendments had to be made, and so Legislative Council has put those in, and sometimes they actually will end up conflicting with each other. So depending on what actually passes through both chambers, there will obviously have to be some conforming amendments. So if you see a particular statute in one bill and go, wait a minute, I thought we changed that, you have to get the right topic area. And so the table of contents should help you with that as well. So with that overview, I would just like to start with the presentation.
Go ahead. I think somebody's taking care of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the first question to ask is, why do we even have government ethics laws in Oregon? And it's pretty clear that, and it was mentioned by the Attorney General, that public
just a minute, Wendy. So could somebody take care of closing the curtains, too? Good.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, we'll close the blinds. Yeah.
It's the one over there where the sun is coming right in.
That one doesn't bother me. Yeah.
Oh, doesn't matter. Okay. Thank you.
Good. Go ahead.
The first slide is just, why do we have government ethics laws? And it's because Oregonians have come to accept that and want that public office is a public trust. And the first provision in Chapter 244, which is where most of the ethics laws are at, provides that as a safeguard for that trust, the people require all public officials to adhere to the code of ethics. So that's the beginning of the chapter about this trust notion. Just as a quick overview, the voters actually passed what are known as Oregon's government ethics laws by initiative back in 1974. The law commission's package, as I mentioned, which has 10 bills, would make substantial reforms to those original 1974 provisions. The code has actually also been amended several times since 1974, but there's never been a comprehensive revision, and so that's another reason why we had a lot of difficulty getting through the code, is there were lots of changes that were made, and then there was never an overhaul to clean it all up and make it read smoothly. What I want to start out with is just noting a couple of important principles to keep in mind, that these are ethics laws. This is not a criminal code. We have another criminal code that handles those types of issues. For example, bribery, when these types of issues go too far. This is also not a floor to ethics laws. Government bodies can provide more standards on heightened requirements. The House is a good example of that, of having its own ethics rules. What we're talking about today is what ethics laws the Government Standards and Practices Commission enforces. We're not talking about other ethics laws or other statutes. We're talking about what this one agency is in charge of enforcing. And so I want you to keep that in mind. Generally, these laws do prohibit the use of office for financial gain. They require annual filing of statements of economic interests. And presently, there's not a quarterly filing, but there will be with the Law Commission's recommendations. That's the first time you'll see in italicized font quarterly filing. Throughout this presentation, you'll see italicized font, and that denotes that there's a recommended change from existing law. So if it's in regular font, it's just present law, and if it's in italicized font, it's a change. The laws also generally require disclosure of conflicts of interest and disqualification from actions when there is a conflict of interest.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. I was chairing. excuse me, just a minute. Ms. Johnson, would you respond to a question, please?
Sure.
Have you been taking questions?
It's my impression that laws generally do not require disqualification from action. They'd require disclosure. And if you could put some parameters around that issue for me, please. Thank you.
Sure. Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I will be explaining conflict of interest in a little later, but generally, if you have a potential conflict of interest, you're to declare it and you can proceed. Doesn't matter what type of public official you are, whether you're elected, appointed, an employee, whatever. But if you have an actual conflict of interest, generally all public officials are required to not participate. They're required to recuse themselves from participating in any action. The only exception in Oregon law presently is the legislature. And that is the question you raised earlier, is that one of our bills does recommend changing that exception and no longer permitting legislators to participate when they have an actual conflict of interest. There is a large exception to conflict of interest. It's the class exception. So that's not considered a conflict if it affects a class. And so many times you might think you have a conflict. For example, you're a teacher and there's an education bill. The class is so large that you wouldn't be considered to have an actual conflict generally. But if it's your business that's going to be benefiting from a particular bill and you have an actual conflict and you're not part of a class, then the Law Commission's recommendation is that you should not participate in that decision as other public officials do. For example, a city council person or a board or commission, they're not permitted to participate if they have an actual conflict of interest presently.
Senator Perriello.
What would be a recommendation, or did you consider the possibility that that the final arbiter of whether the conflict is actual or potential is in fact the member? And that in some cases a member may not wish to vote on an issue simply because they wish not to go on record on that issue, and might be inclined under the recommendation to simply declare a conflict of interest in order to avoid a difficult or controversial vote. What would prevent that?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I don't think that issue was actually raised specifically about avoiding a vote. I would just call your attention to the actual text of the bill that provides that it's the representative or senator we're recommending would still vote on the floor, but it would not be voting on in committee. Because the reason would be that you're still representing a district, and your vote should still count towards that representation that you were called to Salem to do. But that influence in committee is usually the stronger problem, or the advocacy in committee. But the actual vote on the floor was not recommended to change. Sort of a compromise of how to keep, to allow that actual conflict, but not to permit it to go all the way to continue it even in committee and such, which had been the perceived greater harm.
Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I think I see it. This is an issue that's bothered me for some time. There's no maybe button. Voting in representation of the constituents in your district is a duty. The issue of the conflict of interest, the disclosure of the same, is a duty. It's up to the Senate members and the House members to articulate those rules and to enforce those rules, and we have mechanisms for doing that. But to create a situation where you would allow a member to announce a potential conflict of interest, or even to announce that they feel, in their opinion, they have a direct conflict of interest, and to avoid a difficult or controversial vote, seems to me to be utterly unethical. The fact of the matter is our duty is to disclose potential conflicts of interest or actual conflicts of interest and then to vote. And the action of the legislative action that we take is a vote. And I guess my approach to this thing is to try to make sure that those disclosures happen much earlier on in the process than just immediately prior to a vote, that it in fact happens while members are using their influence in the committee level, in the hallways, in the cloakrooms, in discussions with their colleagues, in op-ed pieces, in public speaking. Those are places where a conflict actually plays itself out to the detriment of citizens of Oregon. The action of taking the vote triggers the disclosure regulations. But I guarantee you in this process, I have seen literally dozens of instances where people would get up, walk out of a committee rather than take a vote, or leave the floor rather than take a vote. And I guess I'm trying to tell you that anything that you do that makes that easier actually will contribute to undisclosed conflicts of interest. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Why don't you proceed?
Thanks. Again, just continuing on with the overview, the laws also provide for a procedure for enforcing any violations of the ethics code, and they also provide for sanctions for violations. Turning now to the next slide, there are a few definitions that I just want to go over because they apply.
Just a moment. Did Representative Baskerville, did you have a question?
Yes, I did.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, would someone go through this and tell me on this quarterly ethics filing with G, Government Standards and Practices. And I'd like to know, what are we going to gain by doing it quarterly versus a year? Is there something here that, how would it help to do a quarterly reporting versus a yearly a yearly accountability to Government Standards and Practices if they were all accurate?
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, I think I'll turn this over to Sam Sears. If you look at slide 25, that's kind of down the road in our presentation. But I'm wondering if
I'm not there yet.
No.
I'm wondering if you can kind of hold those questions towards the end, or we can address it.
Would that be
we'll
okay
wait.
If we wait till
yeah.
we get there?
I didn't
okay.
know it was
Let's
there.
Let's do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Members of the committees, again, looking at the definitions, there are four definitions that I just want to go through quickly because we did make some changes there, and these definitions are important to keep in mind throughout the whole presentation. The first one is public official. Oregon chose back in 1974 to cast the net very large to cover all of state public officials and all of local public officials. That includes all elected, all appointed, all employees, all agents, and all volunteers. So anyone who is assisting to carry out the functions of a local government or the state government, including special districts and all the other types of boards and commissions, are covered by these laws. That means the general provisions all apply to these public officials. There are certain requirements that are not required of everyone. For example, the reporting requirements of statement of economic interest, only a small subset are. But we need to keep in mind that when the Law Commission took on this task, the first question was, shall we keep that net that large to apply to everyone or not? And that's important to keep in mind because if we were to just write a set of laws for the legislature, perhaps our laws would be tighter in some areas and more specific on certain topics. But because we made the choice, the voters did in 74 to cast the net to cover everyone, and the work group studied this issue, and as the Attorney General discussed, whether to make up smaller commissions to tackle certain groups of public officials, the commission and the work group both agreed that, no, we should keep it this broad for this particular function of the GSPC. And that meant there were some compromises on some things that perhaps others would have chosen to make them stricter. For example, the trip issue. We have to keep in mind that those types of restraints apply to the teacher, they apply to the firefighter, they apply to the police chief, they apply to the mayor, whose budget, you know, may not allow for certain things. So we'll get to those in more detail later, but you need to keep that initial premise in mind that this law applies to the gamut of public officials. Second, there's the definition of legislative or administrative interest. Generally, restrictions are only made if you have this type of relationship, if someone has a legislative or administrative interest. If they don't, they're not regulated. They're your friend or a relative or such. Keep in mind that definition is an economic interest distinct from that of the general public that's in a bill, a resolution, a regulation, proposal, or other matter that's subject to action or vote of the public official. Next is the definition of relative. That definition was pretty outdated and it was circular with the next definition, which is member of the household. The member of the household was previously defined as a relative, so it was circular. So if you were engaged, for example, it wasn't actually covering the fiancé or a domestic partner. It wasn't covering all those folks. And so we cleaned that up. But generally, if, for example, on the gift rules, if we're regulating both the public official and the public official's members of the household, and at some points we also cover relatives. And so you need to keep in mind those definitions. You'll see in italicized font several groups of people. The law back in 1974 didn't cover the foster situation, the step-parent, the half-siblings, the domestic partner situation. Our family units just look different today. So you need to keep those definitions in mind.
For the record, Sam Sears with the Oregon Law Commission, Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I want to talk a little bit about financial gain rules. Financial gain, or the prohibition of financial gain, is really a basic and fundamental law for Oregon for government ethics. Oregon's financial gain rule is governed by what's called the but-for test, and that test is basically using or attempting to use position or office to obtain financial gain that would not otherwise be available but for the position or office, and that is prohibited. So if a public official is acquiring some kind of financial gain because of their office of public official, that's what would be prohibited. And again, that's one of the basic prohibitions or one of the things that GSBC covers. Also, avoidance of financial detriment would also count as financial gain. The next few slides to follow kind of go into elaborate on those rules and also talk about some of the exceptions to financial gain. The next issue is nepotism. I'm going to jump ahead here. As Wendy mentioned, the italicized portions are new law. So it would appear, I think, that this is all new law. In some respects, it is that these provisions are spelled out. But if you look at the note on the bottom, you would see that these laws are currently enforced by the GSBC, but it's under prohibitions against financial gain. This has been somewhat confusing and hard to understand what the actual rules are by looking at the financial gain statute, so the Oregon Law Commission decided to spell out those rules. They're not substantially changed from what the actual practice of law is in this regard. Again, those general rules are that a public official cannot basically employ a relative. There's a note there, a public body may hire a relative, but the public official may not participate in the hiring. So if you have a spouse working at DHS, that the other spouse isn't precluded from working anywhere in the agency, just that the spouse who's currently working there cannot hire that spouse. There's also a prohibition against direct supervision of a spouse. However, the Law Commission recommended that public bodies be able to develop their own rules in this regard, and they can either go below that or above that. And by that I mean if there is a public body, and I think what the Law Commission had in mind was in maybe smaller rural areas where it may be difficult to have a situation where you would have a public official who is supervising a spouse, like maybe a school where if one spouse was the principal, you know, to preclude the other spouse from working there as a teacher might be difficult for certain areas. So there is this exception that there is a general rule that one public official may not directly supervise another, but public bodies can make their own rules in this regard. There are two important exceptions I wanted to point out for the nepotism laws generally. One is for the Legislative Assembly. As you know, this is current practice that legislatures may hire relatives, spouses, children, I guess. Under current law, there's no reason why this should be able to happen. I mean, this is something that could be, I guess, a violation of current law. But it is current practice to allow this to happen. The Law Commission decided to keep this provision or keep this practice as part of law in some ways to maintain the status quo in this regard. One of the reasons to do that was a recognition, really, of the I'll say the lack of funds that maybe the legislature has to hire staff and also it may be difficult to hire. I mean, family members can sometimes do things that having them work for public officials or legislators can be very helpful, and they will probably often do things for less money that I guess regular staff wouldn't. So again, that's one exception to this bill. The other exception would be for unpaid volunteers, and that's simply that, you know, public officials can hire unpaid volunteers.
I've got a question, Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm just thinking about, okay, let's just say I'm Hardy Meyer's sister, mm-hmm. and I want to apply for a job at the Department of Justice. Would I then be denied employment just because I'm related?
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, it would be my understanding that a person would not be denied employment, but the Attorney General could not be a part of the hiring process. So the public body, the Attorney General's office, could hire a relative of, say, the Attorney General, but he would not be involved in that hiring process.
Okay.
Moving to the next topic is financial gain, and it's in the employment area, a little more specific than what the previous slide was on nepotism. First, in present law, there's a prohibition on accepting future employment or pledge or promise on an understanding that you'll make some vote or take some action. That's present law. That's pretty subjective and difficult to prove. And so the work group discussed this potential problem and is recommending something that's akin to what's in the professional rules for lawyers that prohibits public lawyers from accepting a future job while they're working on a case for the opposite, the other side. They can't accept employment unless they're off that case. And it's a standard that's common in states. The recommendation is that public officials should not solicit or receive a pledge or promise of future employment from a person who is involved in a matter in which the official personally and substantially is participating. So it's not that you couldn't start negotiating a future employment while you're still in the job. It's just that you would have to take yourself off of any issues that would come before the body while you're in that negotiation. So you didn't have that in front of you as I was explaining it. Making it more objective. If you've got something before the body, you can't be negotiating. The next one here is a revolving door prohibition for legislators. The commission's recommendation, as you'll see here, is that a legislator may not receive money for lobbying for one session. There have been questions about whether we're prohibiting lobbying, period, and yes, it is. It's whether you go into lobbying for a private or a public entity is the recommendation of the commission. The next prohibition in this area of subsequent employment is that a public official may not receive any direct beneficial financial interest in a public contract that they authorized or participated in for at least 2 years. Normally, this would be considered a conflict of interest, but it's difficult to show when you're no longer a public official that now you go out and get hired for this contract that you participated in. So it's difficult to prove, and so this provides an objective test of you can't receive benefit for a contract that you authorized for 2 years.
Wendy, I had a question. So you don't make a distinction between lobbying as for a public or a private entity, but it is permissible to accept a job that might later involve that, but as long as you're not doing it for this period of time for which it's prohibited, is that right?
Correct.
Could somebody become an agency head and just refrain from lobbying in that position until the time had elapsed?
Correct. The third bullet is it's explained in you can catch it in the bill in more detail, but the point is that the perceived harm is lobbying the very folks that you were a member of before. And so the work group and the commission didn't see any distinction between going to lobby before that same body, whether you're working for a private entity or another public entity. It's still lobbying. It does not prohibit anybody from taking any job in the public sector. It just prohibits lobbying for that public body. So, for example, an agency head, there's no requirement that they actually be the one who comes over here and does the lobbying. They could send a deputy or another staff person. But the perceived harm is the influence that they'd have or the revolving door in effect.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Yes, could you clear this up? The red is proposed changes. And in our sheet, we're supposed to, these are italicized?
Yes.
Supposed to be. It's hard to determine what is italicized or not. So it's a little confusing, but the black is current law, and the red is what the proposed changes are. Just so I'm clear about that.
Vice Chair Imperioli, Senator Nelson, yes. For this particular slide, yes. Throughout the whole presentation, anything I italicize is new. But sometimes the colors are not always the same. But traditionally, you try to go with red and green.
Well, Madam Chair, how are we supposed to follow this stuff? I mean, it's fine, but what is what? That's what I'm getting to. I guess I need more education or something, but it's sort of a symbolic of what we're all trying to do here. What does this all mean?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Senator Nelson. I'm sorry to credit. We're trying to shrink, you know, piles of paper down into about 12 pages, but we will provide you with summaries of each bill as those bills are introduced or come up for hearing in committee. Tonight we're trying to give you the kind of overview of everything that we're recommending, but also kind of show you how does the law fit together presently, just to get the overview. But again, I apologize for the font.
Sure. Senator Farioli.
Yes, I have a question about the movement from the very general to the very specific. In the existing statute against financial gain, the prohibition is against any pledge or promise from anyone on the potential to influence the action or the judgment. It's a universal prohibition. That would prohibit a third party from providing a pledge of future employment who's not directly involved. In the more specific prohibition that you're suggesting, it is simply a prohibition against a person who is directly involved in the matter. And what I would say is that that moves from the general prohibition of any offer to one that is very much more specific, that would prevent a person from making an offer who has direct involvement in the matter. And I would tell you that that demonstrates to me a rather naive proposition that there are not coalitions of interest inside and outside this building from which an offer of future employment might be derived, where you would have great difficulty in demonstrating the involvement in the matter. So the prohibition in the existing statute is general because it prohibits any pledge or promise on behalf of the public official, or any pledge or promise that might be given by a person with the understanding that their judgment or action could be influenced. It's a much better prohibition because it's much more general. The more specific prohibition simply is ignorant of the fact of the potential of hidden conflict or coalition, where an offer comes from a distant third party but in fact is designed to influence the vote.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I think I would be happy to talk to you about that in more detail, but the focus between the difference between part number one and number two is that to find a violation under present law, you have to show that there's an understanding of a quid pro quo. And under the second one, there's not this, you don't have to show an understanding. The point is there's a prohibition on negotiating a future job if the future employer has a matter before you. So you don't have to show that subjective test of, am I negotiating so that I'll do something, which is very, if not impossible, for the GSBC to prove. The second point is a much more objective of, you can't negotiate.
You're not making your case, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The last bullet point on this topic is a prohibition on consulting for a fee before the very body that you're a member of. Again, this would generally be considered a conflict of interest, but it's caused a great deal of confusion for people at local level and at the state level, and so this is a recommendation to be more specific on this topic. Subsequent employment is already regulated highly for a number of officials in Oregon, and they're listed here. Some of them restricts their types of jobs they can get. Some of them just restricts whether they can lobby or not. We did not change the list of folks who are restricted with regard to subsequent employment. Another area is confidential information. This is a pretty straightforward, quick one. Present law says that you can't use confidential information for further gain. The problem is it doesn't say what happens once you're no longer a public official, and so we're just extending it to that you can't use that confidential information once you're no longer in office.
Go back to that one.
Oops. I'm sorry.
Senator Farioli. I think the question would be, how is confidential information defined? What is confidential?
like, I know Senator Courtney's favorite foods. Is that confidential information under this?
Chair Brown, I don't believe confidential information is defined. I think it's up to the body. I think we're talking more about executive session type information or contracts that I don't think it, frankly, applies to the legislature as much as it applies to locals and other government bodies.
All right. Thank you. Context is useful.
Now we get into the exceptions, which is, frankly, where more of the controversy and difficulties arise. There are lots of exceptions to all these prohibitions that I've just kind of gone over, the specific employment exceptions and such. The first big one is that, obviously, you can get paid to be a public official. That's an exception to financial gain to the but-for test. The problem has been, what does compensation include? And it was never defined, and it caused great problems. Some public bodies wanted to include cell phones, some wanted to include a car, some wanted to include frequent flyer miles and such, and that caused great difficulty for the GSPC, who had to define that rule for everyone. So the Law Commission's recommendation is that it includes compensation as determined by the public body. So, for example, Oregon already has a prohibition on using Oregon has a prohibition on using cell phone or frequent flyer miles for state agency persons who, because obviously the state flies a lot, so they pool those miles. But a small district in the middle of nowhere may not fly enough to require their people turn over their miles. So this is just leaving it up to each body to define what compensation package means. The rest of the exceptions are existing law, except for this last one of legal expense trust fund. Present law does not permit you to give a gift or any other kind of donation to people if they have a legislative or administrative interest. So if you have a lawsuit against you, you can't collect money to pay for legal fees. And so we'll explain that later on another slide, but that's would be a new exception to the financial gain prohibition list.
I just wanted to point out for the record, there are no small jurisdictions in the middle of nowhere.
Point well taken.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
I was just wondering, are they going to be something about that more directly?
Yes. Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, the two asterisk ones, honoraria and gifts, we're going to go into those next in great detail. The rest of them that are the reimbursement of expenses, unsolicited awards, there's really no details on those. Those are just exceptions to present law, and we weren't going to go into any detail, but the honoraria and gifts we will go into great detail. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sam to talk about honoraria.
Honoraria, of course, is something received for speaking or speaking engagement or something of that nature. Under current law right now, there are generally not limits on what can be received for honoraria. There are some, I think, rather convoluted exceptions. One of those includes legislators, and the Law Commission decided to just limit or to put a limit on receiving of honoraria. There is a de minimis exception, and that is for $50 that public officials may receive for honoraria. One point I think I'd like to point out or mention regarding honoraria is that it is involved with speaking duties as it relates to you being a public official. So if you're speaking in your capacity as whatever your other profession is, whatever it happens to be, a lawyer, a doctor, what have you, that would not be governed by this law. It's only as you speak as it pertains to you being a public official. So the law on that is relatively straightforward. This next slide here just points out the differences between current law, both the limitations and the reporting requirements.
Sam, can I stop you just there for a minute? If it would be agreeable to everyone, can we ask folks to write down questions and we can come back to them? I'm just starting to get concerned that we're on slide 11 and we have approximately 31 left and that perhaps we would like to get this done this evening. Would that be okay? Thank you.
Chair Brown, that would be great. And to also mention, you know, these bills will be coming before
the your respective chambers individually, at which point we can really answer questions. We thought it would be helpful to have this kind of broad overview to kind of put everything in context.
Okay, so we've gone through the first exception, which was honoraria. The next big exception to financial gain is gifts. Gift has is defined in statute. It has what a traditional definition, if you will. It's just something of economic value given to a public official or a relative or a member of the household without valuable consideration. So you didn't pay for it, which is not extended to others who are not public officials. So if everybody gets it, it's not considered a gift. You don't even have to worry about it, this rule. But that's what the definition of gift is. Then the general rule is recommended by the Law Commission is that public officials may receive gifts from any person except from a person who could reasonably be known to have... I'm sorry. I'm more comfortable with my own notes rather than the PowerPoint. Public officials may receive gifts from any person except from a person who could reasonably be known to have a legislative or administrative interest. That's sort of present law. Some of you may know that it's circular right now. It says that you can't get gifts from anybody unless they have a legislative or administrative interest. It is totally against what you would think, but that's present law. There's an administrative rule that sort of fixed that problem, but the recommendation would be to clarify that gifts regulation only has to do with those who have a legislative or administrative interest. And then if the person has a legislative or administrative interest, the limit would be $100 aggregate. $100 and then aggregate for the year, the gift could be $250 from the same source. This $100 is important because it's clarified in the bill that you no longer can bundle. In other words, you can't be getting a $500 gift because a bunch of folks got together who each chipped in $80 under the present threshold or something. It's $100 value of a gift, period, and $250 for a year. This is a significant reduction in the value, even though perhaps it may not appear that way at first blush. Present law says that you can have a gift of $100 per source, but you can also have up to $250 for entertainment per source. So present law is $350 worth of gifts for the year. The Law Commission's recommendation is $250 total per source for the year. Questions have arisen of why $250 and why the $100. It was a compromise, and it's to address the fact that these laws do apply to all public officials. So if a person received a wedding gift in January, they could still receive a bouquet of flowers for a death in the family in May. They could still receive a birthday gift or some other token, something or another, at the end of the year. Or they could still provide somebody a gift certificate or whatever. It basically allows people to still maintain relationships depending on what level of public official they are. As I said at the beginning, these apply to volunteers and all kinds of folks. And so we've lowered the amount by $100, and we've also stopped the bundling. So the recommendations are a significant change into the gift limits, but perhaps not as strict as some folks would like still. In addition, we make it clear that each adult public official will have their own gift exemption. It was sort of unclear before. For example, with Senators George and George this session, it wasn't clear, okay, they're related. How does that work? Do they each get their own exception? So it's clear that each adult public official gets their own exception. Now there are exceptions to the gift exception. And I know this gets complicated because we've already said there's the financial gain prohibition, and then there's an exception for gifts. And now there's an exception to the exception. Gifts do not include the following. Gifts don't include campaign contributions. Does not include gifts from relatives and members of the household. Does not include food, lodging, and travel and registration fees. Food and beverage, if it's consumed by the public official. And then these are new ones: continuing professional education, registration fees, membership dues, and publications for use in public officials' official capacity. We're going to be going through the asterisk ones in more detail. The ones that we're not going to be going into detail are the gifts from relatives and members of the household, that's a, even if they have a legislative or administrative interest, that's exempted out. And the continuing professional education registration fees, this could be teaching education, this could be judges. It applies to lots of folks who have other professional positions that fees might be waived. Also includes dues in professional organizations and publications. There's no specific exception for those presently, and those have always been difficult to, for the GSPC to deal with as well as public officials. We'll go into more detail on the asterisk ones. The first exception is campaign contributions. Some people may ask, well, why does it touch campaign contributions? That's in present law, it's an exception to the gift law, so we literally looked up most every rock in Chapter 244 of the Ethics Code, and that was an exception to present law, and we looked at that, and it's obvious that if you're going to limit gifts, you can't leave campaign contribution use totally unlooked at. For example, if a person gave you a computer, and that person happened to be a lobbyist with the legislative or administrative interest, if they just outright gave you a computer, that would be a prohibited gift because it went over the $100 rule. But if the person gave you $1,000 and wrote the check to your campaign, and then you could turn around and buy yourself a computer, we wouldn't have done anything if we didn't regulate the campaign side of the equation. If we only regulated the gift and prohibited it, we would still be allowing the same prohibited behavior. So the Law Commission and the work group did discuss the issue of campaigns in Chapter 260 of the ORS, but with a very limited issue of this issue of financial gain as it relates to gifts to try to deal with the same type of behavior. The new approach recommended by the Commission is to look at campaign contributions not as being the money of the individual candidate, but being the money, if you will, of the committee that's in charge of the campaign. There were a couple of guiding principles there, going back to the first point about financial gain of what's kind of the big picture of what the chapter regulates, is that a public official should not receive financial gain that would otherwise be unavailable but for being a public official. So a candidate wouldn't be getting this money from the campaign if they weren't a public official, and so it's an obvious, it fits that whole area of financial gain. Second, a principle that guided our work in this area was that campaign contributions should be held in trust and should not be considered the candidate's money. And third, if a public official is doing the work of the public should be paying, and the campaign contribution should not be used. So I see some folks worrying about, well, what can I use my campaign money for? It's the Law Commission's recommendations are that they be used to support the nomination or election of the candidate, basically, period. They could be used also for insurance and to pay certain fines of the Secretary of State. But generally, the Law Commission's recommendation is that campaign money should be used for campaigning. That would mean that campaigns could no longer be used for these, the green highlighted here, transferred to any other candidate or political committee, or used to defray expenses incurred once in office. Fourth, that they could no longer be used to pay money awards, judgments, or civil penalties, except for certain non-criminal ones. Certain Secretary of State fines, the Law Commission recommends, that could still be paid for with campaign contributions, but not all fines. And that membership dues and other things like that should not be should not be paid for by campaign contributions. We, the Law Commission, recognize that this may impact a substantial number of legislators who presently do use campaign contributions to pay for their expenses incurred in office. And I'm not here today to judge anyone, or, in fact, it's perfectly permitted by present law and actually says, you know, that campaign contributions may be used to defray office expenses. It's just the Commission and the work group recommends that policy should not continue. But if you're going to take away that use of campaign contributions, we recognize as a Commission that would mean that the Legislative Assembly should be paying its staff more, or provide more of a budget and provide more money for staff. Because if you look at campaign contribution use, which I did, you will see that lots of legislators were paying for salaries, and they were paying for computers, and were paying for paper clips and paper because they did not have enough money in their budget. So we recognize that this has to be coupled with an increase to the assembly's budget. the slide I just went over was the principal campaign committee. I think that's important to keep in mind that we're recommending restriction of the principal campaign committees of folks on the transfer issue particularly. But for other political committees, we're recommending also to not be able to use the money to defray office expenses or to pay fines or dues. What to do with the campaign money then after the fact? Some people leave office and there's lots of money still sitting there. Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt.
Oh, Representative Hunt.
Okay. What to do with the leftover campaign contributions? The Law Commission recommends that leftovers only be used to donate to a charity or another political party committee or caucus committee, or this is in statute presently, the property and supply stores account of the legislature. That's basically your expense budget is what that fund is called. If you're a legislator, you could donate the rest of your money there. The other area that we looked at in the area of campaign contribution use was the treasurer problem of financial gain is the goal to not allow financial gain to public officials, except that those are expressly permitted. Well, how can we help control that behavior? And one of them would be to not allow the treasurer to be the candidate, except if the campaign is a very small campaign, less than $2,000, or the campaign is totally funded by your own personal funds. So that's a change to present law. The present gift reporting, the reporting thresholds are complicated. It's $73, and it keeps changing with time. The Law Commission is recommending that gifts be valued that are valued over $15 be reported. There's also no requirement in present law that the public official actually report, only that the lobbyist report for gifts. We think that's confusing. I mean, the commission agreed that that's confusing to have all these different requirements of what you have to report, what the lobbyist has to report, and a threshold. So generally, you will see a $15 threshold throughout, and you will see that both the public official and the lobbyist and the entity will be reporting instead of different numbers for the various players here. Moving on to food, lodging, and travel. There is no current limit, and the reporting has strange numbers. It's $148 if you're the public official and $73 if you're the lobbyist. The Law Commission is recommending that if it's greater than $75, it should be reported for both the public official and the lobbyist. This one is one of the exceptions to the $15 rule. Nobody can really travel anywhere for $15, and so we put that one at $75. Also, there was a problem in present law that it wasn't clear that registration fees were covered, even though it's food, lodging, and travel. And so if you look at the fine letter, you won't see that they could pay your conference fees. And so we clearly put that in. Food and beverage consumed in the presence. Presently, that's unlimited. The Law Commission recommends that continue to be unlimited. We fixed the members of the household problem. This one was difficult. And it's an exception to not having this one would not require the public official to report. It's just too complicated to try to figure out how many, what the value of a reception was and such. And so we're not recommending that change, that food and beverage, if it's consumed in the presence, the public official does not have to report, but the lobbyist or the entity would. Entertainment, present law is $250 per year. The Law Commission is recommending that it be treated like a gift and there no longer be an entertainment exception at all, that it would have to be just treated as a gift.
Wendy's kind of touched on some of the reporting requirements, and I just wanted to make a few statements regarding the reporting. It really goes, these things go together with the Law Commission's recommendations regarding gifts and reporting. The Law Commission did make some changes to kind of tighten up the gift statutes and what can be received, but really focus more on reporting so that there would be a transparent system. And one way to do that is to try to clarify the reporting requirements, make them the same for lobbyists and public officials, and try to use consistent numbers as much as possible. And also, and this goes to Representative Esquivel's question from before, to require more frequent reporting of the type of things that maybe would be received throughout the session, those things that are kind of changing or dynamic. There are basically, in that regard, then, two types of reports that would be required. The statement of economic interest, which is going to be a yearly report, and then this quarterly reporting that I'll kind of discuss in more detail later. I think you're all familiar with the statement of economic interest. Again, this is something that requires certain amounts of information, source of income, property, and such. I think you've all filled these out, so you're pretty familiar with them. And this is not something that's required, as you know, of every public official, so that however many there are in the state, 170,000 or whatever, there's only certain public officials that are set out in statute, about 4,000, I think, that are required to fill out a statement of economic interest. So again, as I mentioned, this is going to remain, it currently is an annual report. It will remain an annual report, and this sets out the information that's required in the statement of economic interest. Again, it's a listing of positions as an officer or director of a business, listing of all names under which person does business. This is a change from current law right here. It's a listing of the five largest sources of income. The income requirements that were set out in the statement of economic interest currently are, I think, somewhat confusing. It's different percentages based on, you know, over 50% and 10%. And the Law Commission thought that this was a simpler way to kind of get at what the point or what this part of the form is supposed to be getting at. So it's just simply your five largest sources of income received. And again, I'd want to point out that this also applies to the public official and then members of the household of the public official. So, for instance, if one spouse is the legislator and that other spouse works, then those would probably be, you know, two of the things that were listed on that form. And then another thing that the Law Commission recommended beyond this economic interest that's new is a list of names of the public officials, relatives, and members of the household that are over 18. And this is really for a couple of reasons. One, it's hard to determine who those people are sometimes. So as far as enforcement purposes, if something requires a GSBC or a public official to report members of the household, their income or something, it's probably important to have their names on the SEI. Another reason was so to kind of let the public official know, kind of cue them or kind of warn them in advance that, oh yeah, some of these laws apply to my relatives, such as the gifts, receipt of gifts. You know, if your relative receives a gift, you know, and the list of relatives can be somewhat broad. A public official may not think to include that in you know, your yearly aggregate amount. So that's one of the reasons to have that on there. This next slide, I don't want to go through this in detail. It really just goes through what current law is, and that there aren't significant changes to this, listing certain things that are required on the SEI. Next, I get to the quarterly report. Again, this is supposed to be a report this information is generally contained on the SEI, but this was moved to a more quarterly report, and the idea was to have kind of the static information, things that aren't necessarily changing on the SEI, to kind of present a snapshot, and then having these things that are maybe going to be accumulating throughout the legislative session be reported in a more timely fashion. And again, the issue really is, especially when taken in light of the gift requirements or the recommendations that the law commission made regarding gifts, if you are still going to have those and allow legislators to do certain things, I think the best way is also to have a reporting system so that there is a certain amount of transparency of what is going on. You know, are these legislators traveling to educational conferences and getting money for that? or taking other types of elaborate trips, and really it lets others kind of decide what is the positive use of that kind of money and what isn't. There's two other things I'd like to mention in regard to the transparency. The Law Commission also recommended, and this isn't on the slide, but electronic filing system, which would obviously be easier for the public officials to file these quarterly reports and more efficient and be more available to the public and kind of help with that transparency issue. And there would also be, there's also a recommendation for accuracy audits of these reports. Currently, these reports are sitting in a file in GSBC's offices, and having an accuracy report gives this some kind of bite, making sure that these are accurate. Obviously, that gets into other issues of what GSPC can do and funding issues, but that is a recommendation that the Law Commission thought was important to actually make these forms a little more worthwhile. And again, there are four things that are required to be on these quarterly reports. We've gone through these in the other slides, but I'll kind of go through them now. It's expenses for food, lodging, and travel. Of course, is over $75. $75. Sources of income over $1,000 to an official or a member of the household of that official, if it's from an individual with a legislative or administrative interest. A listing of the payer and the date of for honoraria of money received for the public official or the member of the household, and then of course all gifts over $15. There was another recommendation Law Commission made about being able to file amended reports. This is so that people can, I think, frankly, if something is missed and it's an honest mistake or something of that nature, public officials have the ability to file an amended report. So they may see someone else filing something that listed something that they maybe didn't think was a gift or something like that, and this allows a public official to amend a report within 30 days of the filing deadline and not incur a sanction for that.
Sam, I just want to add on that one that since the lobbyist and the entity and the public official will be filing on the same quarterly, you're going to be able to check with each other instead of what's present law, which is the lobbyist is at one cycle and the public official is at another cycle. And so everybody's on quarterly, the 30-day sort of time to amend will keep everybody on track and will allow for more frequent disclosure, but also just to make sure we don't have these mistakes.
Thank you. This next slide is just the value of reportable items. Current law provides persons who provide a public official with food, lodging, and travel to notify the public official within 10 days after the expenses were incurred to let them know how much that was for reporting purposes. And that same requirement is for gifts within 5 days. One change that the Law Commission recommended is requiring public officials to make a good faith estimate if they did not happen to receive this type of notice regarding gifts and travel.
Okay, members, we're now moving on to conflicts of interest, which we're leaving the financial gain area. Now we're moving on to conflicts of interest. The big picture difference is with financial gain, you're in office and now you're getting something because of your being a public official. Conflict of interests are dealing with things that you already bring to the job. Those interests that you have, the economic thing, I mean, the property you own, the other jobs you may have, what your relatives bring to the job, that type of thing. That's the conflict of interest issues that we're going to be dealing with now. The basic definition of actual conflict of interest we're not changing. It's just if any action or decision or recommendation that you make, if that would be to the private pecuniary gain or detriment of yourself or another, a relative or such, then that's an actual conflict. A potential conflict, we're not recommending change to that either, but it's that it could be to the private pecuniary gain or detriment of the official or the relative. There are a couple of exceptions regarding memberships, actions affecting a class of persons, et cetera. And those are important to keep in mind, that, especially the class exception. the basic rules of the game for conflicts of interest is that there's disclosure and there's disqualification if you've got a potential or an actual, and that's the big difference. Generally, if you've got a potential, you can still participate. You just need to disclose. If you've got an actual, generally, you can't participate. So you'll see that we're not recommending any change to any of the categories of public officials, the categories being the assembly, judges, and other elected public officials, with the exception of the legislative assembly, which was already addressed earlier tonight. There is an exception under present law that has caused some confusion. There's an exception that says it's not an actual conflict just because you're a member of a nonprofit organization. And so there's not even a requirement to disclose that you're involved in a nonprofit. The work group considered that issue and recognizes the need of if you always found a conflict when there was a nonprofit issue, you might never get a vote taken. But the work group considered it and said, you know, that makes sense to not find that to be an actual, but the other members of the decision-making body should know that you have that interest, and so the recommendation is that you should disclose it. There's also an exception here for mutual funds that was kind of an anomaly issue that I have to give credit here. Chair Shetterly, being the bond type person that he is, suggested that we shouldn't find an actual conflict if you have ownership in a mutual fund and you don't even know what's in that mutual fund. And then this is present law that if there is a conflict, it has to be recorded. The Law Commission is also recommending an additional disqualification rule in addition to the conflict of interest rules. As I explained at the beginning on conflicts, it's focused on private pecuniary gain, meaning financial. The Law Commission is also recommending disclosure and disqualification requirements if you have a financial interest that's personal to you or you have an individual personalized bias for or against an identifiable person whom the person knows to be a direct object of the action. This would extend the conflict of interest rules and redefine it a bit to extend beyond just looking at financial interests. So if you engage, I guess this gets at friends or if you're making decisions on a family member, not in a family member that already would be covered, but your long, you know, time best friend or something like that, that you shouldn't be participating in those types of decisions. It generally keeps the same framework that would require disclosure for potential and disqualification if you have one of these types of interests. The GSPC, as Commissioner Greg Mao explained, the commission discussed with the great length whether it should be changed at all in terms of the structure. The commission did not recommend changes to the actual membership or to the executive director position. We're recommending the same format, which is 7 members presently, and they're it's basically a volunteer position. In fact, it only pays for their travel expenses. With respect to the GSPC duties, we are recommending quite an additional list of things we think the GSPC should be doing. Those are represented by the green line, the green writing there. We're recommending to provide online reporting and provide public access to all filed reports. They presently already do provide a manual that is supposed to summarize the chapter. We're recommending, but it's not in the statutes that we're recommending, but that we're recommending that manual be redistributed more widely. Presently, it's not distributed. Many years ago, it was distributed to public officials across the state, but it's just not anymore. But we're hoping this online reporting and public access will help in that regard. The GSPC presently is to provide a continuing education for public officials and lobbyists. We're recommending that be done just more extended. They don't have enough staff to actually train people on a more deliberate basis. If there's a request to do training, they will come and do it, but there's not a systematic training of all teachers or all mayors or all police officers. There's just no systematic training, and so what we found in our research is that many folks who these laws apply to don't even know that they exist. We're recommending that the GSPC have accuracy audit authority to do audits of sample of all the reports that are submitted. We're recommending that they continue to address the complaints and those that are initiated on themselves by themselves, and also that they continue with investigating. I note here that the Public Commission and the Legislature, as well as the Law Commission, recommend that if a controller position is legislated as a nonpartisan office, then the Law Commission recommends that investigations be done by that nonpartisan office. I should have mentioned earlier on the campaign contribution restrictions, the Public Commission on the Legislature also recommends the same restrictions on campaign contribution usage. We're recommending more rulemaking, and we're also recommending some differences on advisory opinions, which I'll explain. Presently, the GSPC does have rulemaking authority. It's very broad, but they frankly haven't had the funding to pay for the legal expenses of engaging in rulemaking and actually having hearings to get feedback on rulemaking. We're recommending an annual rulemaking on reoccurring topics. If you've looked at the GSPC website, you'll see that there are lots of opinions, but they're not searchable, and the statutes are really broad, and so the detailed issues of what do I do about my cell phone and what do I do about the car or those types of things that keep coming up would be a lot handier for lawyers and for public officials if they were addressed in rule, and so we're suggesting an annual rulemaking. We're also recommending that state agencies and statewide organizations, and that would include the League of Oregon Cities, for example, or the counties or special district associations, that they should be able to submit their policies or at least selected policies for review to see if a public official follows a particular policy, whether that would pass ethical muster under the law, under the code. And if it would, then if a public official followed that rule, they would be okay. They would be held in violation. That will help deal with some of the specialized public official areas that are just difficult to sort of walk through under the general ethics code. The GSPC, as some of you may know if you've called up them, will issue advisory opinions. There are three different types of opinions. There's written commission opinions, written staff opinions, and then just staff advice. We're recommending some changes in all three, basically to provide more shelter to a public official who goes to the trouble of asking for advice and then follows it. We're recommending that advice be considered when sanctions are if sanctions are imposed. If a public official asks for an opinion, and it's a written official opinion from the commission, we're putting a timeline of 60 days to get that to the public official, and it would provide precedential effect, meaning you couldn't be prosecuted for any action that was based on that. I mean, obviously, if you went outside the scope of the requested information and forgot a few facts that were a part of your request, then you could still be prosecuted. But if you followed, if you did what you said you were going to do and they said it was fine, then it would provide precedential effect. On staff advisory opinions, you'll see the shall consider. It requires the commission or the court to consider the fact that an advisory opinion was sought and relied upon. And for staff advice, it also allows the commission to consider it. Basically, we're giving the commission more tools to enforce its rules, but to not have to impose the fines that are in statute, to have some leeway with those fines based on the actions of the public official. Moving on to the enforcement process, the first recommendation there in green is that when deciding whether to proceed, we want to put in statute the GSPC must consider the public interest and prior and likely future sanctions. In other words, if there's a criminal suit pending on a major bribery issue, it seems sort of redundant to also have the GSPC go through the same process. And so the GSPC should consider the prior and likely future sanctions before it goes ahead and prosecutes. They haven't felt they had that leeway before. Here's a note again about the Office of Comptroller. There are two phases to the enforcement process. There's a preliminary review phase and the investigatory phase. Basically, we're not suggesting changing that preliminary phase, but this is the confidential phase of an investigation. The investigatory phase is open to the public. It's basically they found cause to go forward. We're recommending extending the timelines because the GSPC only meets about every 6 weeks, and it's too the timeline is too short in the present law. In the green here, you'll see that at the close of the investigatory phase, the commission can either dismiss an action or continue it or move to a contested case proceeding if they found a violation. Present law allows an opt-out. Excuse me. Allows an opt-out to circuit court rather than following the traditional Administrative Procedure Act process. The Law Commission is recommending something like an Administrative Procedure Act process, but with a little bit of a twist to still allow for this potential opt-out to circuit court. The way it would work is that if the GSPC found cause to go forward, to have it submitted to the Office of Administrative Hearings, the public official could request a circuit court opt-out, and if then the GSPC could decide whether to refile.
Madam Chair, would you take a minute? Let's just take a minute.
Thank you.
If anybody has a cough drop, all I have is chocolate.
I'll take that.
Pass it down.
Can I start coughing?
Senator Johnson?
Nothing. You read my mind. I was going to take a break.
Take a break. Oh, okay.
The record, thank you very much. Just for the record, we are passing around Campfire USA almond caramel clusters. We think it avoids all of the gift limits that have been talked about in either chamber and every
the house have to share a cookie.
Thanks, Senator.
Chair Brown, Chair Rosenbaum, I guess.
Oh, man.
All right, good shot.
I think I left off with explaining the investigatory process, or the investigatory phase. What happens at the end of that is the GSPC can take an order, and we're recommending to change the opt-out, which presently allows any public official to say, no, don't go the administrative route. You have to go circuit court. The way that the Law Commission recommendation would go is the public official can request the circuit court refiling,
the GSPC then could either refile in circuit court as requested or give final order authority to the Office of Administrative Hearings, to the ALJ. In other words, so the commission itself couldn't change the ALJ's order. It would become final, and then that order could then be appealed to the Court of Appeals. This was a difficult issue to deal with, this expensive issue, and it is an anomaly in administrative law. But this would get it closer to being more like a traditional administrative proceeding. Moving on to legal counsel issues, some people may ask, well, what about who represents who in these cases? The Attorney General's office represents the GSPC. So the Attorney General does not represent any public official before the GSPC, nor generally do county council or city council for a body. It's you're on your own before the GSPC Ethics Commission. In fact, it says in statute the Attorney General shall not represent a state public official before the GSPC. Present law provides that if the public official wins in a contested case proceeding, they shall be awarded attorney fees. We did not change that recommendation. We did provide for a legal expense trust fund to help pay for these costs.
The next topic is sanctions for government ethics violations. The current amount of sanction, or the maximum amount right now, penalty is $1,000. That is the original amount from the statutes when they passed, I think, in 1974. So the Law Commission recommended increasing those amounts to $5,000. On the other end of the spectrum, the Law Commission also recommended that GSPC be able to file a letter of reprimand, so there would be no fine with this type of sanction, but there would only be a letter of reprimand. This is for when a public official is found to violate some ethics regulation or rule, but maybe it does not rise to the type of violation that would require a fine. So the GSPC can issue a letter of reprimand. Another note I'd want to make regarding sanctions is that the Law Commission recommended that the GSPC adopt rules regarding two things, appropriate fines and something like a matrix. That would give public officials kind of better notice of what types of violations would lead to certain fines and provide more consistency in these fines. Also, it would provide public officials with a notice of what types of things constitute multiple violations, such as maybe using a cell phone, or is that one violation, the use of that cell phone each day, or is it multiple violations? So could there be a penalty of $5,000 for each one, or does it just constitute one violation? Again, this would be rules that the GSPC would put forth or set out to give better notice to public officials. The other fines are current law, and Law Commission recommended just to keep them as they were. Other issues that I would point out regarding sanctions, there's a different type of sanction set up when reports are filed late. The maximum amount for that right now is $1,000, but there's an accrual. It's set up to accrue it a certain amount each day. This amount is increased. It's $10, as you can see, for the first 14 days, and then $50 each day thereafter. And I guess there could be a maximum of $5,000 if somebody did not pay or did not file in time. There are also criminal here finding a false swearing, a statement of economic interest, is a Class A misdemeanor. And finding a violation of GSPC constitutes prima facie evidence of unfitness where removal is authorized by law. And this is a final recommendation, or the recommendation that Law Commission made in regards to sanctions, where the gift receipt must notify the public body of the public official when that public official violates an ethics law. That would just give, I guess, the employer or the public body notice that their public officials are violating laws where that is undue.
Okay. Next topic is other remedies. Present law says that an action's not invalid or voided simply because somebody forgot to or intentionally didn't disclose an actual or potential conflict. That's the only thing it says that about actions. What happens when a public official was disqualified and participated? What's to happen with that action? The only thing in present law just says that if it was just that there was a failure to disclose an actual or potential, it's not void. But it doesn't say anything else. Law Commission is recommending some additional guidance be provided to governments and the courts. The list here is that if a public official acted when disqualified to do so, the act remains valid if the government body reaffirms the act, or the official's act was solely a vote in a collective decision and the vote was unnecessary, or the act was permitted by the rule of necessity. That's how you could attack the underlying act, which had disqualified a public official.
Next is funding. Law Commission and the work groups really struggle with the issue of funding and really look at a spectrum of options regarding funding, including assessments on local governments and assessments on lobbyists and such. In the end, the Law Commission decided to recommend that funding come from the general fund, solely from the general fund, and that there be a separate fund that's established for the GSBC where an amount is set, I guess this session, kind of a base amount, and then that amount would increase based on an adjustment. I note on this, in regards to funding, I mean, the Law Commission really looked at assessing local governments and determined in the end that the cost of maybe administratively or the administrative fees that would go into making that assessment didn't really or outweighed the benefits of something that would, I guess, the insulation that would come from having separate sources of funding. Again, this is an issue that's obviously still before you and one that they struggled with as well. I would make a point regarding funding. You know, the only way to really insulate a budget, I mean, there's some level that can be done short of a constitutional amendment, but the only way to really insulate the GSBC's budget is to have a constitutional amendment. I think this is something you're aware of, but just a note I would make regarding this. Another aspect of the funding that I would want to point out is that the Law Commission recommended in a separate kind of non-statutory recommendations regarding how much should be allotted, that the GSBC should have 6 FTEs allotted to it, and one of those being a full-time trainer. The Law Commission, going through this process, really recognized the need to both enforce ethics violations, but also reach out to public officials and provide training and provide education so that public officials would better know what is a violation and what is not.
The last slide is on lobbyist regulations. It's a short slide, not because their laws are shorter, but we've pretty much already covered all of their laws by doing the previous slides, because what we really are going for is the matching up of the same requirements that public officials have that the lobbyists would have. So you'll see that we are clarifying the 24-hour rule, what it means to have to register, but the reports are going to be the same. The lobbyist must file a quarterly report that has the listing for food, refreshments, entertainment, the listing of expenditures over $75, and the listing of gifts. This would be required for both the entity and the lobbyist. Sanctions would be the same as for public officials. Excuse me. That pretty much wraps up the overview of everything. as we said at the beginning, there were 10 bills of how we, this whole presentation is broken then down into 10 bills that focus on given subject areas. Those are listed in the report that you have before you. There are also, by what we're tracking, about 12 more bills in either the House or the Senate that are on the topic of ethics that are not recommended by the Law Commission but are recommended by or are introduced by various folks in the building. Two bills so far have been moving, House Bill 2589 regarding the revolving door and Senate Bill 10. Those two bills obviously have differences between the Law Commission's recommendations, which would have to be worked out if any or all parts of the Law Commission's bills would go forward. I would be remiss to not thank Ted Rettlinger for his work in writing these 10 bills for us.
Okay, we're going to give you a break, and we're going to ask some questions, and you can just nod your head or have Sam say yes or no. I did want to point out before I lose any more of my Senate members that the Senate Rules Committee will not be meeting tomorrow. Mr. Rettlinger has been out for the last couple of days, and we're a little behind the eight ball in terms of amendments, so we will not meet tomorrow. I know that the House is planning a trip to places beyond, and we really appreciate your invitation to include us, but member schedules wouldn't allow that to happen. So any quick questions, Senator Representative Rosenbaum? Did you want to start on
any
your side?
House members, do you have any questions for our panelists?
Well, yeah, actually I do. I have several questions. If we go to page 9, slide number 18. And it states in there the treasurer may not be the candidate unless $2,000 or less combined contribution expenditures or candidates use only personal funds to fund the campaign. Now, my question is, in the community that I came from, which is a nonpartisan council and non-paid council member, we do expend more than $2,000 in an election normally. But what my concern here is it's very difficult to get someone to step forward with the stipulations and the rules of being a treasurer for such a small campaign when they can, I believe, get up to a $10,000 fine.
I don't know if you two want to answer that or we want to bring up members of the commission to respond. Mr. Mao, Mr. Attorney General, either one of you want to respond to that? No? Okay. Go ahead. I'm just a little worried about
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel. We did talk with the Secretary of State's office about this threshold level, and their this $2,000 is a level they already have for different types of reports that are required, and so we wanted to keep it the same number that's used for their small campaigns that don't require the same paperwork. In addition, we found out there aren't that many truly small campaigns, but they're usually there's a bunch clustered a lot higher, and then there's some, the truly small less than 2,000. And so we arrived at that number based on that kind of analysis of what we felt had the potential for abuse, but recognizing that it is difficult to get treasurers, that's why there is the provision that allows for insurance. And that fines could be paid for through the campaign contributions for certain fines. Now, if you're taking money for personal use, you can't turn around and use campaign money to pay the fine. That's an exception to not being able to use your campaign money to pay fines.
Representative Esquivel, do you mind if I ask a question on top of that question?
You can ask a question on top of my question if I can answer that on top of yours later.
Sure. I think the concern is the fact that treasurers can be both held individually liable, and I think the concern is not that that we're not going to be able to find people, frankly, to do this work because of the liability issues, and I can't remember whether it's criminal or civil, but it's bad. I remember it's bad. So,
Chair Brown, members of the committee, with respect to that issue, present law says that the candidate and the treasurer are liable. My understanding from the Secretary of State's office is that in a given matter, they will pursue whoever the guilty person is. I mean, if it's the treasurer who's taking the money for personal use, the treasurer's the one who's going to be liable, not the candidate. That's not who they're going to go after. But present law already provides that the candidate is on the hook as well.
Okay. Thank you. Turn it back to you.
Yes, and my last question is, could you help an old man out that can't read very well and has poor eyesight, and could I get something here of a colored version of this so I can distinguish between the letters, because it's very difficult for me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Does not look like it. It looks like you have answered them all.
We have a few down on this end, and I've been requested by the Good Center for Ailey to ask the questions. The good news is, because I'm asking them, they'll be shorter. So, and I actually have a question for Mr. Burson, if you'd come up here and at your convenience. When the campaign restrictions, one of the issues is, what about the way the campaign piece was written? Are then campaign in-kind contributions prohibited? So you can't take, you can only use your campaign contributions for campaign purposes. Can you still accept in-kind contributions? And I'll go back to the computer exemption. You can't accept a computer for your personal legislative use because it's a gift outside the limits. Can you accept a computer for campaign purposes under this proposal, and then also use it in your legislative work?
Chair Brown, I think that's a great question, but I don't know the answer.
Okay.
I'm going to get back to you on that one.
Okay. I actually do have a question, too, that relates to this slide. And this is that I asked about this in some of our previous meetings, that under the rules that both chambers operate under, there is a blackout period that exists for 60 days prior to any election when we cannot use our official budget funds for a whole host of purposes, you know, communicating with constituents, things like that. And so even if your recommendation did follow through and we got an increase in those budgets, we still wouldn't be able to use them. So how do you see that working with this prohibition?
Chair Brown, Chair Rosenbaum, with respect to that issue, that is in your own rules. It's not in statute, just my understanding. And so this is a Chapter 260, that these prohibitions on what campaign contributions can be used for applies to all campaigns, whether it's for governor or legislature or for judge. And so this prohibition on not using campaign contributions for defraying office expenses applies to all public officials. So if that creates a problem for the legislature, it would have to amend its own rules to deal with the defraying office expenses issue.
So, in other words, your suggestion is that we just not have this blackout period anymore? I mean, that's been a longstanding practice for us. And it's meant, really, to take away some of the advantage of incumbency.
Right. Chair Rosenbaum, I understand the issue, but I think it can be limited to what you can use your office budgets for, and it's just defraying expenses of public office, and you can define it to be narrow to answer the questions of constituents or whatever. You can narrow it rather than saying you can't do mass mailings during the blackout period. But I think you can narrow the rules to address your incumbency issue, but still not be using campaign money to do public work. And that's the premise of this set of recommendations, is that campaign money should not be used to do your public work. It's really, frankly, only a legislative issue. You know, the governor, the attorney general, a judge is not using campaign money to pay for their paper and their paper clips and their staff. It's really a legislative issue, and that's why we have a note at the bottom that the reason it's even occurring is there is the provision in present law that says you can use campaign contributions to defray office expenses, and the problem of that your budget has been so low that you've had to go to that source.
So under this proposal, under this recommendation, that would prohibit the use of campaign dollars to send, I'll just use at the outset of the legislative session, a mailer to your constituents asking for their opinions on 5 hot issues. That right now, a number of us use campaign dollars. The Law Commission recommendation is that you couldn't use campaign dollars for that particular purpose, even though arguably in the future it does support your election.
Chair Brown, that's a specific hypothetical that, you know,
would require a legal opinion, but I think the Secretary of State's office will have to help further define what campaign expenditures are and what debris once in office. But if it's for doing your public office to get feedback, it looks like public office work. And the problem is your present budgets don't have any of that constituent allowance. I mean, your budgets are so small, you don't have a travel budget at all. I mean, you're a public office, but you're one of the only public offices that I know that doesn't actually have the same kinds of accounts, that expense accounts, that other public officials have. And so we recognize that this is a departure from present practice, but we were asked to provide policy recommendations, and this is the recommended policy change.
Okay. And one last follow-up in this arena, and I guess I'm assuming that based on the Law Commission recommendation that you would be prohibited from using your campaign dollars to supplement legislative staff, but that you could still use your campaign contributions to pay staff that are actually working on your election during the time frame. Is that right?
Chair Brown, that's correct.
Okay. And then one last, Mr. Burson, actually, could you come up, please? Just a quickie question for you. We've been talking about a couple of folks who have a legislative or economic interest, and I think the question has come up whether or not legislators have an administrative or economic legislative interest, and whether Oregon's current ethics rules prohibit gifts that we give, for example, to a former speaker who got a grandfather clock and members pooled their money. Is that currently prohibited under Oregon's ethics laws?
For the record, Ron Burson, executive director for the GSPC. And again, that's, you know, that's kind of a specific a question that I'd have to get a legal opinion on.
Okay.
It's hard for me to answer that.
Okay.
A specific example like that.
All right. But is it clear in your mind that legislators themselves have legislative interests so that member-to-member gifts are covered under Oregon ethics laws?
Chair Brown, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe I shouldn't ask that question.
No, I wish you hadn't.
All right. And then lastly, there's clear prohibitions regarding household members, and I guess I don't recall any specific. I know that the member or the public official can be punished under Oregon's current ethic laws. Can the spouses be punished or the members of the household? And I guess that would also apply to the Law Commission recommendations as well. I think I'd probably have to pull up a slide. But let's say a spouse of a member or a public official violates the ethics ban. Is then the spouse held accountable under Oregon's ethics laws?
Chair Brown, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that right
okay.
now. I can get that information to you.
All right. I think that would be helpful. And I don't know, Wendy, I don't remember the Law Commission addressing that specific issue at all.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson for the record from the Oregon Law Commission. My understanding of the ethics laws is they apply to public officials. And doing the counting, it's the spouse dollar numbers of a gift counts into the public official. So it's the prosecution would be against the public official.
Okay. Senator Johnson, any questions? Senator Johnson.
Yes. I sat through what at times seemed like an interminable number of meetings on this subject over the interim, and I guess I would have a couple of observations. First of all, as we have romped through this subject area, it seems much more complicated than it started out to be when we began this odyssey prior to the interim.
Yes.
The fact that the head of the Ethics Commission has just been asked a couple of questions that he can't answer, and this is no reflection on you, but it just startles me a little bit. I think that the goal here was to satisfy ordinary Oregonians that there was not some unfair advantage being afforded to legislators, and it was some very specific and I would say in some cases egregious and criminal behaviors that brought us to this tipping point where we needed to do something. But I'm not any more satisfied now, after having done this for nearly 16 months, that I know still whether or not I can pay for a hotel room when I sleep all night in Tillamook and I don't want to drive home in the snow. I still don't know what account to pay that out of.
We are hinging a lot of what we would constitute define as success on things that are beyond our ability to control, like pay increases for legislators, so we stop this movement of money between accounts. I am especially pleased to see that the recommendation of the Law Commission has to do with the transfer of money between candidates and elected officials. I think there should be much more transparency there, and while it's no secret that political parties and the leaders of those parties raise money on behalf of other candidates, I'm not sure the public is cognizant of how much money moves around behind the scenes. And we really, other than the Law Commission's effort to touch on that here, haven't really talked about that very much. But my large concern is with, I don't know how many bills going through, both the ones generated by the Law Commission, Senate Bill 10, others that were self-starters from other legislators, I am coming to the point of despair that we're going to do anything that assures the public or reassures people who are trying to play by the rules that we know what the rules are. And I just keep trying to figure out what's the problem we're trying to solve here, because over the last almost 2 hours of your presentation, we've been everywhere. And at the end of the day, I don't know what we have to assure Oregonians that we have made this process have integrity and be one that is reflective of the values that I think Oregonians wish to see their legislators possessed of. So that's I really am not asking for an answer. I'm just sort of venting that having sat through all these meetings, I'm not sure at the end of the day we're delivering a product that satisfies what the public wanted.
Senator Johnson, thank you very much, and we really appreciate your service to the Law Commission as well as the good Representative Vicki Berger's service to the Law Commission. Did you have a question, Senator Johnson?
You would appreciate my service, or I'm one of the bad boys that took the trip to Hawaii.
No. I didn't realize you were on the Law Commission work group.
I was not. I was in Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
I'm just kidding. And I really have to apologize. And I don't mean to make light of that. I do have to apologize to the legislature and my fellow colleagues, because I mean part of this is coming out of something that I wasn't intending to do anything wrong. I didn't, you know, I took some advice that was bad and wasn't trying to bilk anybody or anything, but it was made into this big thing. But okay, let's go back to
that. But Sarah Nelson, I think Sarah Johnson's point is well taken, and I think we have a current set of statutes on the books that frankly are a hodgepodge and not very clear.
Inscrutable.
Okay, whatever. And that was just made clear by the question I probably shouldn't have asked tonight. And then we've got Law Commission proposals that I think have done a pretty extensive, thorough job, but the question still remains, you know, will the public have a sense that we have really made a change? And at the same token, will they be simple and clear? And then there's a whole lot of other bills that we've been talking about. So, Senator Nelson, go ahead.
And on a serious note, really, when I went through this, I thought, I don't understand any of this stuff. And who's going to administer it? And was the standards and practices folks ever consulted and asked what is practical, what can be done? I mean, I think Ron Bursin asked the question, one of our committees said, well, that's a wonderful idea, but there isn't any way I can ever administer that. And I just think on the practical ground for how are we going to make this thing work?
Mr. Burson, would you be willing to make some comments and kind of respond to Senator Nelson's question about whether or not you see the Law Commission proposals being workable on the ground?
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, what I see the biggest benefit of the work that's been done is that, first of all, I think we said at the beginning that it's not complete and that it's still a work in progress. But a couple of things that Oregonians have asked our agency for is the transparency. And I think the Law Commission, in their recommendations, is talking about some type of online, not only reporting, but also making that information available to all Oregonians. Currently, basically, Oregonians have to come to my office down the street here and pull the records out. And it's pretty cumbersome to do that. So that's one big benefit from, this pile of bills that come out of here that is going to serve Oregonians. The second thing is that if we can simply match what a person can get compared to what a person has to report, so that my agency can come back and actually audit these reports, that would be a huge benefit. to people. Currently, right now, we basically rely on outside resources, looking at our information, looking at other information, and seeing if there's any kind of discrepancies. And then they go and investigate that, and they find a discrepancy, and then they report on that through some means. And without those two matching up, and the Law Commission does do that, tries to get the amount of that of a gift, not only what you receive, but what you report, to be the same. And that will be a big benefit. There are lots of things in here that I think that we need to work more on, but I think that they have started the process, and I know it sounds like it's really hard to understand, and it is, because so much has been thrown at you at one time. I mean, these folks did, 16 months, or actually some people say almost 4 years worth of work, and it's been thrown into an hour and a half presentation all at one time. And so I think it is difficult. But the biggest thing that we can do for our guardians is, first of all, report the information so that if somebody wants to look it up, they can look it up and find out what has been spent on public officials. And that's not just you folks up there either.
Thank you.
Everybody, all public officials that are out there. I'm sorry, all the SCI filers that are out there. But and then the other thing I'd say is just matching up so we can actually do some work inside the GSPC to audit the reports, make sure that it's matching up.
Yeah, thank you. A couple comments, if I could. I was speaking to Senator Nelson in the break, and he's saying this is a complicated mess. My remarks are, you should have seen how bad it was before we started. This, believe it or not, is incredible cleanup of some. Now, is it finished, or does it ever end? And does it address some of the issues that are most highest on the public's mind? Maybe, maybe not. But you got to start somewhere, and there is a lot of cleanup in this series of complex, because it was worse before. Also, I'd like to say that Pat Hearn, the previous director of GSPC, was on the work group right up until literally the day he left for Nevada, and then. Where Mr. Versus comes in the middle of a conversation that was long and complicated. It's like you walking in tonight, just for the first time seeing all this. Oh my gosh, deer in the headlights. And so that's sort of where we are. And then go back to my original remarks, which was, it's important that we go through this and validate what we believe we should, and change what we believe we might, or this is not a finished product. This is the framework for some really serious cleanup that, as the legislature and these committees, need to look at.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, following on what my friend and colleague from the House just said, maybe there is an admonition to all of us here that we don't have to hit a home run at every at-bat. And with Mr. Burson's and the Commission's help, maybe we could identify those best elements that satisfy the public's concern out of all of these bills, out of the Law Commission's recommendation, and really treat this as a multi-year work in progress. And get some very clean fixes that provide the desired amount of transparency and are clearly demonstrable to Oregonians that we're moving in the right direction, and then make the conscious decision to stretch this out over many sessions.
Whatever we're willing to pay for, I'm sure the Law Commission will be willing to provide the work. Senator Nelson, do you have...
I think another consideration is besides the public's right to know, and I believe very strongly we should be reporting just about everything so that they can check on. But we also have a constitutional rights of First Amendment. There are certain rights that we're guaranteed. And whether that's part of the ethics or whether campaign finance reform, there are certain rights that I think complicate this matter more. It's just not only the person's right to know, it's what our guarantees under the First Amendment are, and there's some tension there, and so that concerns me. Is that because we had testimony from one of our committee that basically said, "Well, we were trying to skirt the constitutional First Amendment because we thought there was harm there." And so my question was, "Well, you were assuming there was harm. Maybe there was good there. I mean, there's an assumption and." What I see and what I've learned, as I recall going back, that if we try to answer every individual potential example, we're going to fail. But if we leave it flexible, there's open and full reporting of what we're doing, so the public has a right to inspect us. They're the ones that are actually going to make the decision in the election. You know, it's and what I see with all these things that happen is, you know, somebody during the middle of a campaign can file a complaint, say he violated whatever his contribution, saying he didn't do his SEI, and maybe there's no substance to it. But the damage is done during the course of the campaign, and that's happened. You know, so.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Roblin, did you have a comment?
Yeah, a couple, actually. The first one has to do with what concerns me the most is that we've sat here now for 2 hours, and I have a little better understanding. But there are thousands of public people out there and volunteers mm-hmm. who aren't going to have 2 hours. I mean, they volunteer for 2 hours a month. They aren't, and yet the amount of time it takes to explain what we've done tonight, to get them in a room so they understand their conditions of employment, even though they're not getting paid, is pretty extensive. And we aren't anywhere near there. This hasn't gotten simple enough for that. And it reminds me of a young man at an elementary school, as a kindergartner at a local school district, who was sitting in the cafeteria about the third day in the school, crying and eating his lunch, and was asked, well, why are you crying? Why aren't you out in the playground? And he said, well, they had this list of all these rules, and they've only gone over half of them so far, and I don't want to go out and break one of the rules that I haven't been told yet. And so I'm thinking, you know, we have a whole bunch of people who are out there who are going to be listening to this testimony, wondering what rule they've broken, and whether they should volunteer or do the things that we really need in our society to make it work. And unless we can get them simple to explain and understand by everybody, so that when those people sign up on the little dotted line, they can feel comfortable that what they've signed up for is not going to put their family and everything else at risk, I'm very concerned. So that's my comments.
Thank you. Well, I certainly appreciate the frustration. No one ever said this would be easy, but I think it's doable. I think that the committees will be able to come to grips with this. I think it's crucial that we do so. I think that the House has already made a start by addressing some things in our House rules, and they aren't perfect either, but we have been managing to live with them and fine-tune them as we go. So I think that I would just applaud the Law Commission, both the staff and the members of the commission who've appeared here tonight and worked so hard to bring us this very good starting place. So I really thank you for presenting it to us tonight. And I think at this point we are prepared to wrap it up. So I will close the informational hearing on Senate Bills 494, 495, 496, 497, 498, and House Bills 2594, 2595, 2596, 2597, 2598. And seeing nothing further to come before us tonight, we are adjourned. Senator Brown.
Let's go home. Thanks, guys.
When to get better.
Cheers.
Yeah.